is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We really appreciate everybody taking time this afternoon to join us for another edition of Midrats. And for those that are joining us live, I'd like to point you in the direction of the show page. If you scroll down to the bottom, that's where you'll find the chat room. That's a great place if during the course of the show you have an observation you would like to share with our other live listeners, or if there's a question that you would like for us to direct to our guests that it doesn't appear that we're actually headed in that direction, that's a great place to do it. We'll be monitored during the course of the show, and we'll be glad to fold in your good ideas as we move forward. And if you have some honeydews you got to take care of and you're going to miss part of the show, or if there are previous shows you would like to catch up on, as always, you can get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can head on over to iTunes or Stitcher and subscribe to the free podcast. And if you do that, give us 5 stars if you wouldn't mind. I'll try to sell a little soap here. That helps help us keep above the din, so to speak, and we can get more listeners on the show. So we have more people to contribute as we go forward. And let's go ahead and dive into today's show. And today we're going to have on another author guest for the full hour, which we always enjoy doing it because it gives an opportunity for people to have things to add to their Christmas list, because we're still in time to order in time for Christmas, and to give authors an opportunity to flesh out their work and some of the ideas that they're trying to get across to the reader. And today we are going to have on board Seth W.B. Folsom, U.S. Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel. He is the author of Where Youth and Laughter Go. This is his third book. As a published author, he put out his first book back in 2006, titled The Highway War, A Marine Company Commander in Iraq. And he followed on again with In the Gray Area, A Marine Advisor Team at War in 2010. In today's show, we're going to discuss where his latest book is, and also probably discuss some of the broader aspects of the Marines during the course of the long war in the last decade and a half from his perspective, and perhaps some other issues of the long war that the listener might find of interest. But hey, let's go ahead and dive right into it, and I'll go ahead and save our good friend Seth the trouble and let him know that he is still on active duty, and he is here as an author just to speak for himself, and any comments or observations he may have made are strictly his and do not necessarily represent those of the Department of the Navy or the United States Marine Corps or Santa Claus for the holiday season. And Seth, welcome to Midrats.
Thanks, gentlemen. I sure do appreciate you all having me out here. It's great to be able to talk to everybody.
Yes, sir. We really appreciate you taking the time this beautiful Sunday to come talk with us. And as I outlined in the opening, this is your third book about first person of Marines in combat in the course of the long war. In this case, it was your time as leading the 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines, and Sangin and Helmand Province. If you could, for the listener, kind of outline for us where and when you were with your prior two books and how you see your third book, Where Youth Go, in the course of Marine leader's journey.
Well, that's a great question. You know, the first book is really, it's about me and the company of Marines that I was the commander for in 2003 during the invasion of Iraq. And I had I trained with those Marines and sailors for about 2 years before we went to Kuwait for the invasion. And during the course of our time in Iraq, I kept a journal on a daily basis to record what was happening around me, because the events that were occurring were so much larger than life, and so much larger than the realization that there's something finally that's out here that's bigger than me. And so what ended up happening was my Marines saw me writing in this journal routinely, and they would periodically ask me what I was writing about, and then I told them, and they would periodically say, you ought to write a book about us. And I, most of the time I just laughed it off, but the seed had been planted. And so when I returned from the invasion and I moved on to Monterey to go to graduate school there, I was in the process one day of going through my notes and going through my journal, and I realized that, there's a story here. And the story is not about me. The story is about the Marines and what they were doing and the hardships that we were all facing together. And so once I read and reread it and took some more notes, I realized, I think that there are people beyond me and the Marines in the story, they need to know this, that the people in our country need to know how this happens and what happens when we send young men and women out to fight our war. And so, the rest really is history. I was able to get the story published and get everybody out there to start understanding these stories, this mosaic of stories that have been going on for the last 15 years since we've been in these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then, much the same happened with my second book. When I went forward in 2008 with my advisor team, the circumstances that we'd been thrust into were so bizarre. There was really no other way I could deal with it other than routinely writing in a journal and recording the events as I was able to see them. And it was the same thing. I didn't start out my time as an advisor with the intention of writing a book the same way I didn't start out my time as a company commander or later a battalion commander with the idea of writing a book. But when you are in these circumstances with these young men and women who are just, phenomenal Americans, and the sacrifices that they make on a daily basis and the hardships that they have to deal with and the dangers that they find themselves in, there's always a story. And it doesn't matter what kind of unit you're in, whether you're in a combat unit or you're in an advisor role or if you're in a support unit, there's always a story about men and women who are serving our country.
Yeah, and let me say that you've done a terrific job. These books are great reading. You're an excellent author, and I get caught up in what you're doing. Obviously, I don't have neither Sal or I has the same kind of experience you have, but some of the issues, the leadership, the command, the dealing with people above you and below you, are universal with in the service, and I think that these would be great reads for any young officer or enlisted a man who is looking at getting ahead in the service. Because I think you've really laid out the three books are terrific as you chronicle your own personal growth over the years through the experiences you had. One of the things, let's talk a little bit about the elements that you describe. One of them is leadership. One of them is the training and the discipline required for the people that are in the field. Can you discuss a little bit about how important that is and whether your opinion of those things has changed over the time that you've been involved with these levels of command?
That's a great question. I think Marines and military professionals as a whole, the discussion of leadership and leadership development is something that we never get tired of talking about, because on a daily basis, people are always exposed to good and bad leadership, and there are sayings out there like you learn more from bad leaders than you do from good leaders. I've experienced both, and the thing that I've learned, one of the many things that I've learned over the years, is really, if you focus on the basic things of leadership, the basic tenets, you can't go wrong. And but at the same time, that's, you know, that's easier, it's easier said than done. And what I can tell you is, as a junior officer, you know, especially as a lieutenant and a captain, I always did my best to not make the same mistake twice. That's what everybody strives to do. Don't make the same mistake twice. But in doing so, I think I probably have made every mistake once. I always tried to not make the same mistake twice and tried to learn from the mistakes I was making along the way. But the challenge as a young leader in the Marine Corps, whether you are a non-commissioned officer or a junior officer, is you can make a lot of mistakes, but a lot of mistakes can have pretty serious consequences. And they can result in ultimately in the lives of the men and women that you're in command of. And so that's always been the kind of the golden rule for me is to I know I'm going to make mistakes along the way, and I've got to learn from my mistakes, but I can't make mistakes on the backs of my Marines. And that's there are some things that I've done and said that have been difficult to deal with in the out years, but I think ultimately it has all contributed to my development of a leader now 20 years later.
As we're coming up on a decade since you published your first book, and I'm you and I haven't talked about it, but I'm sure you've had a conversation, as I've had with a lot of, especially young leaders who would like to write but can't seem to take the step into that dark room to do that. And I got a big grin on my face when I read in the note at the beginning of your book, where one of your peers came over and commented to you with a excited tone, "I didn't know you wrote a book." And and your first book was very well received. The 2007 Military Writers Society of America Award for Best Memoir, and your other two books, as my co-host outlined, are just exceptionally good reads to be able to chew through. But I'm curious, as somebody who did step forward pretty early in your career to start writing in the first person, what was some of the responses that you got from your peers and your chain of command and the Marine Corps writ large as your book started to get out there and get recognized and people started reading them?
Well, I'll tell you what, again, you just reminded me that it's been 10 years since the first book was published, and the first thing I thought was, "Damn, I'm getting old." But when I first when I first started getting serious about getting the story published, I didn't do it without talking to a lot of people. You know, I talked to my parents about it. I'm very close to my parents. I talked at length. Unbelievable at length about it with my wife Ashley, because I knew whatever choice I made, especially if I made the choice of getting the story published, she was going to have to live with it just as much as I was. And I also talked to several senior officers who in the Marine Corps whose opinion I valued, and I was genuinely worried. Because what I thought was going to happen was I thought I was going to walk into kind of an L-shaped ambush by these colonels. I thought they were going to say, you know, you have no business writing a book and saying some of these things that you're going to say. But as it turned out, it was the complete opposite. One of the people I talked to, one of the first people I talked to about it was Colonel Joe Dunford. He had been my regimental commander during the invasion, and by the time I had written the book, he had moved up to be the chief of staff for 1st Marine Division. And so I just, on odd chance, I was able to talk to him, and I brought the issue up to him of, you know, I've written this book, and I'm looking for what you think about it. What do you think I should do? And he was incredibly supportive. He didn't say one thing that deterred me from doing it. And in fact, he encouraged it. He said, you know, we need to get stories of the Marines out there, and you doing this is a great thing. And he also, you know, one other thing that he did that really encouraged me was some of the mechanics of how I wrote the book. He actually encouraged me to leave all the names to the degree that I could to use actual names within the book. For a while, I struggled over whether to, you know, change some names or change all the names in the book to protect people's privacy. And he was actually the one who said, you know, do you want it to be historical or do you want it to be a work of fiction? And that resonated with me. And so I made the hard choice to leave as many names in the book as they were. And so many people, and there are many characters in the book, all the Marines and sailors that I dealt with up and down the chain of command. But it made it a real book. It made it a piece of history. And so I was genuinely appreciative that Colonel Dunford took the time to do that for me. So, I was surprised by the reaction that I got. I was pleasantly surprised by the reaction I got from senior leaders. I was not surprised by the reaction that I got from some of my peers and some of the people who had been in my unit. Some people were a little aggravated about what I'd written, and, you know, rightly so, perhaps. Others were surprised that I had taken the chance and put myself out there years later after the first book was published. And actually, it was shortly after the second book was published. I was at my 20th high school reunion, and an old friend of mine had read both the books, and he came up to me at the reunion and he said, you know, man, your books were great. You really put yourself out there. And I was taken back a bit, because I knew the spirit in which he was saying that and that it was a compliment. But at the same time, I thought, I guess maybe I did. You know, I wasn't hiding anything in any of those books. And that was really my intent all along. But the fact that somebody recognized it, like I said, it took me a bit by surprise. But, I wouldn't say that I got a lot of hate mail after the first book was written, because I didn't. But again, there were some people that were a bit aggravated with me. But most of the people that I dealt with who even knew about the book, they were very supportive. But like I said, like I had written in the author's note in my latest book, a lot of people are still surprised to this day that I've written books. And I'm fine with that. I don't have a chip on my shoulder about it, because my job is I'm a Marine, you know, and I do my job on a daily basis. I don't go around advertising to the people with whom I work, hey, look, I wrote these three books, because that's not who I am. When people realize and they comment on it, you know, I'm happy to talk to them about it. But it's not something that I go around and wear on my sleeve. So each book that I have written and that has been published, there's always a bit of surprise by people when they realize that I've done this. But really, there's only been a little bit of hate mail, but that comes with the territory.
Well, I'm not surprised that some people found your book uncomfortable, particularly the people that you went out of your way to allow. I mean, there's one instance in there you describe where you had to let a exo of one of the companies go, but and I'm sure that was uncomfortable. But you know, for the most part, what I really enjoyed about the book was how much your appreciation of the Marines, of the young Marines, of your senior NCOs, your junior NCOs, comes through. For the people who haven't read the book, this is not an I book. This is not, you know, I did this and I'm great and all that. This is a book about you dealing, working with your Marines to get a job done in a very unpleasant location. And I think that that's a terrific piece of an achievement in being able to get that across, at least to a poor old Navy guy like me. So I think that I'm surprised that anybody you know, how many of them, any of them took it in a negative way, except perhaps that one gentleman. But one of the things you stressed throughout this was trying to keep the focus of your Marines on what they were doing, the safety, the discipline, and helping each other out. And as you go through the book, of course, some of the stuff you were doing, you really complimented your young, what was his name, Major McKinley, was that the your ops boss who did yep. such a terrific job. And one of those, you ought to discuss that about the about his efforts on the IED thing and what changed your focus slightly, not slightly, substantially as the your efforts in the Sangin area went forward.
Well, you know, that's the thing is there. You know the old saying that goes, it's amazing it's amazing what you can accomplish when no one insists on taking the credit. And that's really, that was one of the things I think that guided the Marines that were in the battalion and the staff officers that I had working with me in the battalion was everybody recognized that there was a mission that we had to accomplish. And somehow everyone realized that, you know, we weren't going to get any closer to mission accomplishment if people were going around saying, hey, this has to be my idea, or I'm the one who is going to brief this to the boss. It was from my perspective, and you know, I know I could probably be accused of saying this like I'm sitting in an ivory tower, or I was sitting in an ivory tower at the time. But from my perspective, it was a very collegial atmosphere among my staff and among the leaders in the battalion, and there was very much a problems that we went after that we had to tackle. It was a collaborative approach to tackle this problem and to find a solution. You know, what we realized was, what I realized early on was that I could not make just the simple act of the Marines surviving the deployment. I couldn't make that the mission because that wasn't the mission. And as much as I wanted to bring all of these young men home with all of their limbs, I knew that wasn't going to happen, and I had to accept what my regimental commander had told me, which was you need to focus on trying to bring home as many as you can, knowing that you're not going to bring them all home. And I had to distance myself from that and look at what the overall objective was and what our mission was. But I also knew at the same time that for us to accomplish that mission, we had to tackle these problems like the IEDs that were taking out the Marines as routinely as they were. And I knew, first of all, I knew I didn't have the answer. All I could do really was wring my hands and wonder how we were going to defeat the IEDs. And I was able to realize that I had a lot of people around me that were a lot smarter than I was. And that if I could get them together in one room and give them the tools they need and the latitude and the authority, that they could come up with a way to defeat the IEDs. And that's ultimately what they did. I did realize early on that that the Marines and I had been put in a situation where there was no way that we were going to kill our way out of the war. And there was no way we were going to kill our way to mission accomplishment. Because quite frankly, the more violence and the more kinetics that were happening in the district that we were in was ultimately producing more people that were sympathetic to the insurgency. It's the whole idea of, you know, you kill one and two pop up in their place. Maybe not really that bad in reality, but it sure seemed like that in 2011. And so we had to find the balance between going after the bad guys, bringing the good guys over to our side, and surviving the whole thing all at once. And so it was incredibly challenging, but, you know, the people who made it happen were those junior leaders, the junior NCOs and the junior officers. And, yeah, you know, it was the officers on the battalion staff who made it happen as well.
I've always broken the Afghan conflict into the four segments. We had the initial stage from late 01 through about 04, We have what I call the NATO era that started in late 04, went through 08, when they pretty much culminated the summer of 07 when they couldn't even get enough helos down south. Then you had the uplift period that ran from 08 to 09, where you had re-Americanization, and we started to also take back over RC south, west, and north from what was largely little tribal areas from our NATO allies. And you went into, in your battalion, in Sangundown in Helmand province, and back during the NATO area, you know, Kandahar was Canadahar, because that's where Canada used to be till they left in 07, 08. And Helmand was jokingly called Helmandshire. If you could please talk about when you headed in to Helmand, who you relieved, and what was the situation that your Marines were facing once they got on the ground.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about 37's role in Sangin is people are off, there's often some confusion about what my battalion's role was and what the previous battalions had been doing there. Until 2010, the main units that had been in Sangin were the Brits, the British Army and the Royal Marines. They'd been there from 2006 to 2007. They had taken terrible casualties of all the British service members who were killed in Afghanistan. The majority of them were killed in Sangin, so there was a lot of scar tissue on their part about the district there. In the fall of, or the late summer and early fall of 2010, 37 was in RC Southwest in Helmand Province, and they were sent in to actually relieve the British unit that was in Sangin. The unit was the 40 Commando Brigade. And so the 37, this is again before I got to the unit, they went in, relieved the Brits, and they took over the district. And then they were there for about 4 to 6 weeks trying to pacify the district after the Brits had left. And then their deployment came to an end. It was a standard rotation. They were not going to get extended. So they were relieved by 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines. And it was a very complicated relief in place. And there were 3-5 sustained some pretty significant casualties at the beginning of the deployment and then throughout. They were later relieved by 1st Battalion, 5th Marines in April of 2011. Who just by pure chance at the time, one of my closest friends in the Marine Corps was commanding 1-5 at the time. And so 1-5 was in Sangin from April 2011 until 3-7 with me as the commander flew back in September of 2011. So when I was there with 3-7, we took the reins from 1-5. And we had an incredibly well-done professional turnover from 1-5, which was really a testament to their professionalism and their esprit de corps, because 1-5 had been just in constant contact with the Taliban throughout the entire summer. As soon as the summer fighting season started in the May-June time frame of 2011, 1-5 was getting in firefights every single day, and they, throughout the course of their deployment, they actually lost 17 Marines and sailors. And so I had a feeling going into it that you know, Lieutenant Colonel Savage and his leaders were not going to have a whole lot of time to hold the hands of me and my subordinate leaders to show us the district. But it was the complete opposite. You know, they were, like I said, they were in contact every day, but he was taking the time to personally move me throughout the district to see where all the laydown of the entire battalion and where my platoons and companies and squads would be posting. And so we had that turnover in September of 2011, and then the events that are described in the book in Where Youth and Laughter Go take place from September of 11 until April of 12. And so during that period that my battalion was there, it was not during the summer fighting season. It was the annual period where the Taliban, they do just enough to let you know that they're still there, but a lot of what they were doing, a lot of regrouping and a lot of preparation for the spring and the summer that was going to follow. And so we used that traditional down period, down cycle, to target the Taliban as much as we could, and to develop the district government, and the Afghan military forces that were assigned to the district, to develop those three things to the extent where when the Taliban returned in force in the spring of 2012, the district would be transformed and it would be something that they weren't prepared for. I think that we got to that level, but as you know, as history showed it, and it was not long after 3-7 left in 2012 before everything really started to crumble in northern Helmand. And so by the time the Marines left northern Helmand for good in late 2000 or in 2014, the Afghan military and the Afghan police were taking just horrible casualties from the Taliban, and things really began to revert to the way they were before the Brits arrived in 2006, which was very disheartening.
I thought one of the interesting aspects of the book was your relationships with the various Afghani leaders you had to work with and did work with. And there was a particular thing when I think there's a guy named Bayezid who you were kind of forced to confront at one point because you kept putting off his invitation to have chai with him. But there's a great line in the book, like you told him you'd done a good job or something, and then he said, I hoped I could continue to trust him. Like most of the Afghan leaders, he would never lead in the same manner Americans would, but hopefully his efforts would be good enough for the residents of Sangin. And I just thought that was, you know, you have a background, as I guess, in the foreign culture world, but I thought that really nailed it. You know, I mean, we can't go in, if we're going to do these jobs in various places, you can't go in expecting you to suddenly create Burbank, California, or Minot, you know, some other U.S. city. You're dealing with cultures and tribes and all the other attendant mess. I kind of talk about that a little bit. I mean, you had some interesting relationships going with your Afghan counterparts.
Well, it's like you said, you know, a term that is that everyone has begun to adopt really since we were in Iraq, and it bled over into Afghanistan, was the term good enough. And there was the realization that, you know, when we talk about training, advising, and assisting foreign military forces, you know, in particular the Iraqis and the Afghans, we're never going to get them to the level that the U.S. military is at. And, you know, quite frankly, we shouldn't strive for that anyway. But if we can get them to the level of good enough, you know, if we can figure out, the puzzle is to figure out what is Iraqi good enough, what is Afghan good enough, and what that good enough is their ability to exist, operate, and subsist on their own without U.S. assistance. Without a complete U.S. assistance, I don't know that we need to go to that level because, you know, quite frankly, we provide assistance to a lot of foreign militaries who we consider capable organizations. So when we figure out what that good enough is, that's the goalpost that we're aiming for. My frustration when I was dealing with the Afghan military in this case, was a different frustration than I had with the Iraqi officers that I advised in 2008. In 2008, the location that my team was with the Iraqi battalion and the overall enemy situation in that area, there wasn't a lot going on. And so the Iraqi officers really would concern themselves with things that weren't that important, because there was really no enemy that was compelling them to focus on war fighting. They were not taking casualties at the time. And so their biggest concerns were whether or not they could get enough fuel or spare parts for their equipment. However, in Sangin in 2011, the Marines were sustaining casualties on a daily basis. The Afghan military and the army and the police, they were all taking casualties and were getting confronted directly by the Taliban. And it was still difficult for me to compel the Afghan battalion commander and the police commander. It was difficult for me to compel them to take swift and firm and resolute action to show the Taliban that they were willing to stand up for them. And that puzzled me. You know, I remember one day when one of the Afghan policemen had been killed by an IED strike, and I felt like I took it harder than the police commander did. You know, when I saw this guy lying in a body bag, and I thought, you know, this young Afghan man just gave his life to protect his district as a policeman, and his police commander doesn't really seem to care. Now, I don't know if that's an indictment of the Afghan culture or of just the way that particular Afghan police commander was, but I was thinking at the time, you know, if this doesn't make these guys care, if the fact that their soldiers and their policemen are out getting killed on a daily basis, if that doesn't make them care, I don't know what can make them care. I had some similar feelings with my dealings and relationships with the members of the district government. One of the things that I realized was that the overall situation in the district by the time that I arrived there in 2011, although things were bad on the ground for the Marines and the Afghan military, things were actually pretty good in the district for the district residents as a whole. Security was much better than it had been the year before, and there was much more structure to the government. And so I think that gave a lot of the Afghan government officials in the district, I think it gave them an opportunity to complain about things that were really not as important. It was like the quintessential example of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, the security, which used to be the number one issue that confronted them, that was beginning to get better. So then they began to talk about things like, taxes and who was better positioned to lead the district community council, and things that that most people would consider, you know, distractions. And so just as it was difficult for me to compel the Afghan military leader to take action, it was also difficult to compel the district governor and the different councilmen to present themselves and take action that was going to benefit the entire district, not things that were just going to benefit them and line their pockets. And so that was frustrating at times. I knew my role as the battalion commander was both a tactical role as the battlefield commander for the Marines, but it was also ultimately as the senior advisor for all of these Afghan military commanders and the district government officials. I had in my organization, I had several advisor teams that were led by the senior advisor was a Marine major. And really, as much as I could, I pushed that responsibility to him, for him to deal with the military officials and for several of my subordinate officers to deal with the government officials. Because I really wanted to concentrate on the Marines and what their mission was. But the second reason was I didn't want to be the single point of failure for both the district government officials and the military commanders. I didn't want them to think that I could solve every single one of their problems. I wanted them to take their problems to my subordinates so that they had the opportunity to deal with it at a lower level, but also to show these senior Afghan members that the example of what the Marines do really well, which is we put a lot of authority and responsibility in the hands of relatively junior officers and NCOs, which is, it's sort of alien to their culture and their organization. And so then when there were issues that couldn't be solved at that level, I would inject myself. But it was always a struggle for me to divide my time between working with my Marines and patrolling with them and dealing with the Afghan leaders.
Speaking of personalities people run into in the book, it's I kind of got a smile on my face because since I left active duty in 2009, I've told a few people, I said one of the hardest things to do in the civilian world is to try to find the equivalent of a really good senior NCO. It's really, as everybody who's been active duty knows, once you've got one of those, you realize that they're not paid enough. The incredible value they bring to the equation. I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about Sergeant Major Troy Black, and I found it reminded me of some of the best points that have been brought to my attention. Specifically, he mentioned to you the obligation of a commander. There are five things that he needs to consider before he makes a decision, and also it's five or is it six exactly? Indicators of effective leadership, that advice from a senior NCO to an officer, I thought was enlightening.
Yeah, Troy, I'll tell you what, Troy Black is he's a living legend. And I got the opportunity to run into him 2 days ago. And in fact, it's great that we're talking about this because the other Sergeant Major, Sergeant Major Rafael Rodriguez, who was my Sergeant Major for the deployment, he just turned over the command that he was the senior enlisted advisor for here at Camp Pendleton, and he's getting ready to go out to be the Sergeant Major at Parris Island. And so I was fortunate enough to get an invitation to this ceremony, and I ran into Sergeant Major Black there. And like I said, Troy Black, the man's a living legend, and he has – he has the resume to back it up, and he has the just the absolute undying loyalty of all the Marines that he has encountered in his career. What he was for me was he was the best possible example that I could have as a Sergeant Major as I came into the command. He like you were talking about, he conveyed to me those five questions that a commander has to ask himself about everything he says or does or every decision he makes. You know, is it moral, ethical, legal, just, and professional? You know, and if the decision that you're making satisfies all five of those things, it's probably the right decision. And the thing to keep in mind is that, you know, the answer to all five of those can be yes, and you can still be making a decision that a lot of people disagree with or that pisses a lot of people off. But that comes with the territory. You know, being a commander is not a popularity contest. You make decisions that are unpopular all the time. And so that was one of the things that Sergeant Major Black helped me understand. And he helped me understand that when you come into an organization as big as a Marine Infantry Battalion, your perspective, it has to change. You have to look at the organization as a whole, and you have to look at it as a larger body. One thing he used to say all the time was, you're the mayor of a small town. And so one thing that he wanted me to understand was you are in charge of this large organization now that is essentially five or six or seven times larger than the size of the organization you last commanded, which was, for me, a company. So you have to look at this large organization, but you still have to have the focus, which is on the individual Marines all the time. And so I never forgot that, and that was one of the things that I carried forward with me when Sergeant Major Rodriguez and I went to Afghanistan with the battalion. Was by that point I understood the size and scope and the scale of 3-7 and what we were doing. But my focus was from that point on was always the individual Marines and what they were doing. And that was just one of the many reasons why I patrolled with them as often as I did, was because it gave me the opportunity to see what they were doing, to work with them, to understand them, so that when things did go bad, I knew that they were doing the right things and they were making the right decisions. And I really credit that that kind of that foundational understanding with the mentorship that Major Black gave me.
Yeah, there. I thought your relationship with Sergeant Major Rodriguez was exceptionally well portrayed. Terrific. One of the things that you're talking about taking care of the Marines, and one of them was after you'd lost a couple of guys fairly early in your deployment, and you had a little message for them that you said. I'm going to read a section here because I think I even read this to my wife. She thought everybody ought to hear this. You know, you'd lost these guys. You said, we have to put this behind us and continue forward. It's okay for us to grieve together, but once you go outside the wire, you have to set it all aside and focus on the mission at hand. What happened is your business and yours alone. If you don't want to discuss it with anyone at home, that's fine. Watch out for people asking, did you lose anyone? How many people did you kill? It's none of their business. The choice to share is yours to make. I had to experience the discomfort of both questions more than once, and I wanted them to be prepared. I also talked about the anger they might feel once they returned home and the feeling that people back home owed them something. Forget it, I warned them. No one in our society owes us shit. That's the price we pay for volunteering. I just thought, that was so good. That was a perfect message. And I don't know if you got any feedback from them about that, but that was a really good stuff. Did you get any feedback on that?
Well, you know, it's good that we were just talking about Sergeant Major Black, because I first got that, I really pulled that idea from him because of the experience that 3-7 had in Sengen in 2010. When I got to the battalion and took command of the battalion in 2011, it felt like there was a significant degree of anger in the battalion. There had not been a lot of reporting or a lot of coverage about what 3-7 had done in Sengen, and the casualties they'd taken and the really great things that they had done. You know, company size helicopter assault and the just numerous tactical engagements that they had where they were just overwhelmingly destroyed the Taliban fighters. A lot of that was lost in the news coverage of the surge, and months later the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. And so there were a lot of Marines when we started talking about Sengen, they had a chip on their shoulder, and that was something that Sergeant Major Black had picked up on. And so one of my first opportunities to talk to the Marines in the battalion within, you know, a week of me taking command, I always gave the Sergeant Major the opportunity to talk as well. And that was what he talked to the Marines about, exactly what I said later in the deployment, which was, you know, you guys went to Sengen, you did all these great things. Guess what? Nobody cares. You know, that's old news. That's from a year ago. No one cares. No one's ever going to care. To walk around with a chip on your shoulder if you want, but don't expect anything to do anything for you just because, you know, you went forward and did your job that you're getting paid for. And that really, you know, it came off as harsh. You know, and when you think about what these Marines experienced and then what they were going on to experience again on my deployment, but it is the truth. When someone is injured or wounded or killed doing this job, the insensitive thing to say is, well, he signed up for it. He knew what the risks were. And, yeah, that's true. And it's maybe not the best thing to say, but it is true. And this is a job that everybody loves to have. Everybody who does the job, they love it. They know what the risks are. But, we shouldn't be looking for kudos and pats on the back for something that we volunteered to do. Troy Black understood that. I definitely understood it from experiences that I had had in Iraq with those two previous deployments. And I sure as hell understood it once we went to Afghanistan in 2011 and we started taking casualties. As that passage indicated, I had experienced several times people asking those questions about, you know, how many people did you lose and how many people did you kill, you know, and I don't begrudge people asking those questions because they're curious and they don't necessarily understand. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, I write these stories and write these books the way that I do. It's to convey to the people in our country, you know, what young men and women do when they take an oath, strap on a set of body armor and grab a rifle and go to a place like Sangin. And the experiences that they have and the hardships that they face, it's not a video game. You know, it's not a movie. These young men and women who are well-trained, they're mentally and physically tough, they're still human beings. And it still hurts when you see a friend get killed. You know, it still hurts when you are separated from your family for a long time. And the things that you do and that the life that you have to live in those circumstances, the echo continues on long after you've been over there.
Yeah, I'd like to pull the thread on that. I'd also agree that's great advice, and I think the earlier people who wear the uniform know it is better. People really don't care. And I, in the last few years, have helped some people who are writing their resumes for the civilian world, and you get these resumes, I have to send it back to them. It's like, you've got to totally break this down. Nobody cares about 80% of the stuff you put on here. It's just the reality of what's going on. But I also wanted to kind of expand on that concept of telling our story. And I think that's one of the great things about your novel and the other people that are writing articles about what we're doing, is we have to make the effort as best as we can to get the word out. When I was at HQ ISAF, one of the guys from the PAO shop was a U.S. Air Force reservist who actually had a damn fine job in L.A. doing PR work for the movie industry. And it would drive him nuts as he would come out to our little cigar club and join us. He had all these great stories. Nobody would pick them up. They put them on divots, and they just would never get picked up, video, audio. Nobody really cared. The version of sea blindness or war blindness that, you know, nobody would really, even back then, want to pick it up. But there's an internal problem, too. I wanted to read a little bit of a long quote from your book, because I'd be curious on your thoughts on what we can do internally to tell our story. And here's the beginning of the long quote from your book, from page, if anybody has their book handy, they can follow along on the hymnal on page 418. Beginning a long quote, 3/7's exploits were news to me. Despite my previous job at headquarters, Marine Corps, where I had the privy to a great deal of operational information, I had no idea about the battalion's operations in Sangin. Neither, apparently, did anybody else. Months after 3/7's return to the United States, after a visiting general spoke to the entire battalion in 29 Palms, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines had relieved 3/7 in Sangin in October 2010, and 3/5 immediately began taking heavy casualties. Before it was all over 25 of their men would perish. During his speech to 3/7 Marines, the senior officer proclaimed, interior quote, 3/5 is heavily engaged in a place called Sangin, end quote. Following this pronouncement, the Marines of the Cutting Edge looked at each other in muted disbelief. The officer speaking to them had no idea 3/7 had blazed a path for 3/5, nor did anyone seem to remember that elements of 2nd Battalion, 7th Marines, one of 3/7's fellow battalions in 7th Marine Regiment, had fought alongside the Brits in Sangin all the way back in 2008. End of extended quote. That's exactly what I think a lot of us have seen. We're not even telling our story internally. Why do you think that is? And do you think there are some things we should be doing to at least maintain our institutional memory of what really just happened, but seems this been forgotten?
Yeah, it's a constant source of frustration for me because, just like you said, we're not telling our story, or we're not telling it well. People talk about the idea that after 15 years that we're suffering from war exhaustion, and, you know, it depends on how you define it. Yeah. The our our society may be exhausted by the war, but they're not exhausted from participating in the war. So in one regard, I think that a lot of people in our society, they're tired of hearing about it. A lot of people don't even know that there are still service members dying in Afghanistan, and they've begun to die in Iraq as well. They don't understand it, and like you said, they really probably don't care too much because it's not their problem. I know that's really harsh to say that, but like you said, it's a fact. When I say that we're not telling our story well, I think part of that is because the people in American society who are interested in reading about this kind of stuff and seeing about it in movies, there's a particular narrative that they want to read about. And what that narrative is, and I'm trying not to be too jaded about this, but the stories that they want to read and the movies that they want to see are like first-person shooter type stories. You know, there's this this lust for stories that talk about the SEALs and special forces and the raid forces that we've relied on for the last 15 years to do our most sensitive missions. Because it's a sexy concept, you know. It creates a visual. It's very exciting, and it's what every gamer loves and every action movie lover absolutely looks forward to on the screen. The position that I would take is, yeah, absolutely. That's a small slice of the military and what the military has been doing for the last 15 years. But what the larger picture of what the military, and when I talk military, I'm talking specifically Army and Marines, because they have represented the bulk of the forces on the ground in these conflicts. What those men and women do in combat and in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, there's not a whole lot about it that's really sexy and exciting. You know, Tim O'Brien, Vietnam War veteran and author, one of the things that he said frequently about his time as an infantryman in Vietnam was he said that combat is long extended periods of boredom punctuated by moments of complete terror. And that's absolutely true. There were, of the many, many miles that I walked on patrol with my Marines and the thousands of miles and hours that they all as a whole patrolled during the course of our deployment in 2007, most of that period was long and boring. You know, there were moments, those punctuated moments of the IEDs that were going off and wounding and killing my Marines and the firefights they were getting in. But in the final analysis, those were just moments within a really long 7 months of walking the beat and sanging. And so it's I think it's difficult for the average person to get excited about that kind of thing. And so there's this people naturally gravitate toward the more exciting stories, like the raids and the things that the special forces do. The lifestyle of the Marine infantryman is an incredibly difficult lifestyle. That's one of the things that I tried very hard to focus on in this last book is, the Marine grunt is, he's got a filthy body, he's got a filthy mouth, he wears a physically difficult load of equipment, and he also carries an incredibly heavy burden mentally on what he has to do every day, the decisions he has to make, the actions he has to take, and, whether or not he's going to survive the patrol and then the actions that he takes, how he's going to live with them for the rest of his life. Those are the things that interest me, is that the lifestyle of the Marine infantryman, because after all, in the Marine Corps is built around the infantry. It is built around supporting the individual rifleman on the ground, and that's so. Those are the things that I think that people should understand. The temptation is always there when you're telling a story about a job that has a lot of boredom in it. The temptation is there to only focus on the exciting stuff. But from my perspective, if you do that, then you're only telling a sliver of the tale. The whole tale needs to be told. That was a criticism that about my first book that a lot of people made, which was the fact that I had spent so much time in the front end of the book talking about the training that we were going through before the actual invasion started. And the point, my counterpoint has been and will always be, you have to understand the first half of the equation to see how the rest of the equation fills out. If there hadn't been that explanation of what the Marines went through and the frustrations they dealt with and the environmental conditions, if you didn't understand all that, you didn't have the context for how they reacted later when it hit the fan. And I tried to do the same thing for the third book. Back to your original question, getting the story out to everybody is important to me. And I always, whenever I'm talking to fellow service members and veterans, the moment they express even a modicum of interest in getting their thoughts down or writing their memoirs, the first thing I do is say, just start doing it. Start doing it right now. Go home, open up your computer or a blank piece of paper and start writing. And the answer, whenever someone says, well, I've tried before, I don't know how to write, my answer is, I didn't really know how to write a book either, and I just did it. And that all comes out in editing. The most important piece is getting the experiences down on a piece of paper or on the computer screen.
Yeah, we're going to go over, Seth, with your kind indulgence. I want to read another excerpt from your book as we close out here pretty soon, though. You wrote, the Marines of Cutting Edge, despite the dangers and sweat-soaked horrors they faced for months on end, became the epitome of quiet professionals. Even as they slogged through their impossible mission, they became, as much as possible in a war as muddied as the one in Afghanistan, ethical warriors. As they gradually left their carefree childhoods behind in the hell on earth of the Sangin Valley, they became something seldom respected in the modern age of neutered political correctness. They became men. And let me segue from that into the poem that you got the title of the book from, which is from Siegfried Sassoon. You smug-faced crowds with kindling eye who cheer when soldier lads march by, sneak home and pray you'll never know the hell where youth and laughter go. Just brilliant stuff. I really appreciate you coming on the show with us today. This is a terrific set of books, and this last book is a terrific book all itself. So thanks a lot for being on with us.
Well, I thank you all very much for having me here. It's a terrific afternoon.
Yeah, Seth, it's been a great pleasure having you on, and we can't recommend the books enough to our listeners, and hope you have a great holiday season for you and yours.
Well, I certainly appreciate the opportunity. Thank you once again, and same to you all. I hope you have a great holiday.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much, everybody, for listening to another episode of Midrats. And please join us again next week when our guest will be returning guest Jerry Henricks from Center for New American Security, where we're going to be discussing different paths to the 350-ship Navy that everybody's talking about. Until then, I hope everybody has a great Navy Marine Corps day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.